Everyone, this is Dr. Campbell. We're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. So at 8:30 a.m. on August 12th, 2020, we'll call the meeting of the State of Arizona Board of Podiatry Examiners to order. We will do a voice roll call. Dr. Campbell, present. Dr. Foreman?
Present.
Dr. Ulano?
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Rhodes is not in attendance today due to illness. We also have Heather Brocks, our executive director, and Seamus Monahan, our AAG, are present. We will move then on to the declarations of conflict of interest in any of the cases or agenda items today.
Yeah, hi, this is Dr. Ulano. I have a conflict of interest in regards to an email that Dr. Brewer sent to the board, to Heather Broadwood.
Do you need any further? Is that sufficient enough for his? Okay, thank you.
Oh yeah, I'd like to make a statement in regards to that, if I may.
Is that okay, Jim?
Is that appropriate at this point? Or?
I think it'd be more appropriate when we get to the actual matter.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Ulano. We'll take care of that when the time comes. Thank you so much, though. All right, so we're going to go ahead and move down to our five, the items for board review, discussion, and possible action. And we will begin with A, which is the update of an investigator's review of an audit report. This is in regards to case complaint 18-08-C, Dr. Patrick Farrell, DPM, and Dr. Farrell is present at the meeting. So Dr. Farrell, you can come and have a seat at the front desk here. And Dr. Polakoff is the investigator that is reviewing the audit report. So we'll go ahead and hear from Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, board. This is Dr. Polakoff. In your packets that Heather prepared, would you please tell me, is MO or GL the first case? I can go in order to what you have.
Dr. Polakoff, EM is the first audit report that is on our packet.
Oh, EM. Okay. Then I will... Just one second. Okay, I will go ahead with, if that's okay, GL, while I grab EM, okay?
Pardon me, Dr. Polakoff?
I will go ahead with GL first, if that's okay with the board.
That's fine.
Okay. Just one second. Okay. This is an audit report on 1808C, Patrick Farrell. The patient is GL. The patient was originally seen on this case for an audit in which the doctor performed a tarsal tunnel release. For this, he did a tarsal tunnel release on the patient's opposite extremity, and this case is for her current extremity. On 1/13/20, she was having post-op care for her opposite foot, and this audit was for the left extremity. The surgical consent is tarsal tunnel release. For the left, decompression of deep and superficial peroneal nerve, removal of plates and screws. The patient underwent surgery for the same condition of the right foot with reported good results. Dr. Farrell did a history and physical in which he noted that the heart had S1, S2, regular rate and rhythm. Abdomen was a benign, neck, non-palpable thyroid. extremities and tenelle with palpation of tibial nerve going up into the medial plantar nerve. The anterior ankle gives a positive tenelle into the first interspace on the deep peroneal nerve. And the plantar nerve decompression, as well as removal of the plates and screws of the talonavicular joint left side, was planned for surgery. In review of the notes, the doctor consistently reports the findings of the examinations, but never, the results of the findings of an examination, but he never reports the findings. So if I were to follow up this report as another clinician, I would not know what was done. An example is neurologic exam, neuritis, deep perineal, neuritis, left greater than right, tibial neuritis, left. That is all that I have. That's the report. There are no other findings. There is only statement of the conclusion, but not the findings. The assessment is unspecified mononeuropathy of left lower limb. The plan is debrided keratosis and a heel lift dispensed. In heel lifts, there are many sizes of heel lifts. I would not know how to follow up this patient with a 1/2, 1/4, 1/8 heel lift. And was a heel lift dispensed for the left extremity or the right extremity? The notes that I have reported are all that is present. So to me, it is extremely brief and specific for a diagnosis, but no findings again. On the patient on 10/23/18 had a EMG from a neurologist who diagnosed mild to moderate L4, L5 radiculopathy on the right and left without ongoing degeneration over a bilateral peripheral neuropathy, suggest MRI of the left spine, suggest testing for autonomic and small fiber neuropathy, balance testing. The doctor reported that he tried to get a MRI for the cervical region and for the low back, but it was denied. I find no justification for Dr. Farrell to have even ordered a cervical MRI due to the fact that a suggestion of a compromise of C5, C6 would not have impact on the lower extremities. The X-ray of 8/20/2019, as reported by Dr. Farrell, shows a fused talonavicular cuneiform joint with two plates. There is an oblique on elevation over the first metatarsal cuneiform. That's all it states, which does not make sense for a finding of an X-ray. And the plan is to remove spurs at the first MCJ joint. But he did not state or describe the spurs on the X-ray or any information, which would be hard to follow up by another clinician. The doctor recommended bone spur removal and tarsal tunnel on 10/10/2019. The doctor plan was again to release the tarsal tunnel. The extremities noted, it says limb length right greater than left. Was the limb length differential measured at the PIPJ? Was it measured at the knee? Was it measured at the hip? What was the basis for the limb length differential? And also, how much was the differential? That is not in the notes as well. There was a positive tenelle sign on the deep and superficial peroneal nerves on the right greater than left. Tibial neuritis is right greater than left, with a tenelle sign radiating distally into the medial and lateral nerve plantar. Sharp dull sensation is positive. Vibration sensation is diminished to 12 seconds on the right, 10 seconds left to the first MPJ. Symes-Weinstein monofilament testing is positive on the right, negative on the left. Low back pain in the mid-neck radiating to shoulder. Surgery was performed on 10/18/2019 for tarsal tunnel syndrome right and anterior tarsal tunnel syndrome right. Operation performed is tarsal tunnel release, decompression deep and superficial peroneal nerves. post-op. According to the reports, the dictation was minimal, but appears to be going well. On 11/27/19, the right foot 80% improved with pain, and I had no financials on this report. Does the board have any questions on this one?
Yes, Dr. Polakoff. I believe also on this, and I understand the frustration in reading the chart notes, but this was before Dr. Farrell got his new documentation, his EMR, in action. I believe that happened toward the end of April of this year or so. But I do understand the frustration. What was I going to ask you? So did you, were there any, you were talking about the physical examination. Were there labs, or was there a release, a surgical clearance by a primary care physician, or any indication of the category of anesthesia risk?
I did not find any of that information.
And I also noticed in that exam that you said the heart and lungs were listened to in an abdominal exam, correct?
Yes, correct.
Thank you. I don't have any other questions on this. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ulano, do you have any questions on this audit for Dr. Polakoff?
The question I have, when did he get the new system? Because a lot of these notes are, again, from the previous system, which we knew we were deficient.
Well, that's what I was just talking about, Dr. Foreman, that
right.
It was the middle to the end of April that Dr. Farrell was transitioning. As I remember him saying he was working with the Dragon system and had some...
Yeah,
he was working those
April
out of this year,
okay.
Of 2020, yes.
So right,
that's why I made that remark saying, you know, that we're evaluating the surgical procedures related to nerve decompression in this audit, okay. So.
I have no questions because I'd like to see the newer notes, but.
Pardon me?
I'd like to see the newer system rather than the older ones that we know are sufficient.
Yes, most definitely. Dr. Ulano, do you have any questions?
Sure. What concerns me is the lack of sufficient objective findings. He seems like he goes to the assessment right away, where his objective findings are more like assessments. I'd like to see better notes in regards to that.
Thank you, yes. If there are there aren't any other questions, Dr. Polakoff, would you proceed with the next audit case?
Yes, ma'am. The next one is for 1808C chart audit is patient EM. Patient EM was a referral due to trauma that occurred with a possible fracture of the calcaneus. The patient was sent with a referral that says focused imaging of Arizona x-ray has pain, dorsal and medial right foot, swelling times 2 weeks, status post-fall injury, flattening articular surface calcaneus with loss of subtalar joint suggests calcaneal fracture. Consider further evaluation with DT or MRI to assess acuity, rule out non-displaced fracture of base of second proximal phalanx of MTP joint. On 6/4/19, the patient was officially seen. The patient is a female, 68, positive smoker, on gabapentin, on clonidine, 310 pounds, a blood pressure of 190 over 108. He reports a fall on 5/11/19, fracture calcaneus, limb length discrepancy left greater than right, equinus position, plantar fasciitis right, neurologic neuritis, deep peroneal right, sinus tarsi syndrome right, tibial neuritis right, superficial peroneal neuritis right. There are signs and symptoms of B6 deficiency. My questions at this point, and I had to put questions into each date because there were too many at the end and it would get too disjointed. So my questions at this point, what are the signs of the B6 deficiency? What about the calcaneal fracture, which is not mentioned? Does it hurt? Is it bruised? Is it swollen, et cetera? A conclusion is made for neuritis, but without the findings of the neuritis. Again, limb length discrepancy, left greater than right. What are the findings? Where is the measurement? How much is the discrepancy? All are absent. The assessment is unequal limb length, left femur. That is not mentioned anywhere else in the note. Unspecified mononeuropathy right. No qualifications to make the diagnosis. Plan, debride all nails. He didn't mention the nails were anything but normal. Injection, deep peroneal nerve, sinus tarsi, nerve, superficial peroneal nerve, tibial nerve right, heel lift dispensed. What was injected? How much? Heel lift, what size? Again, the patient was referred from the ER for a calcaneal fracture with an exam performed to this area. What were the findings? Was there a fracture? In the neurologic exam, again, a conclusion without substantiated facts. To go on to the next visit, which would be on 6/25/19, follow-up of injection, was given X-ray report with fracture information highlighted. X-rays show no sign of fracture. That was the whole report. This was billed as a 99213. The problem focused exam, the E&M components of a level 3 visit have not been met. The 7/10/19 exam review CT scan for right foot, dispensing two pair of ortho shoes today. CT shows no fracture or dislocation. Plan, RX given for Kirby brace with arch support, bilateral. Dispense two pairs of ortho shoes. What kind of ortho shoes? Are they traditional diabetic shoes? Are they post-op shoes? For two pairs of ortho shoes, are they to wear one for each foot or is one for the possible fractured limb? Questions arise. On 7/1/19, the radiology report showed subcutaneous edema, mild diffuse demineralization of the distal tibia. The anterior and posterior subtalar joint space appears unremarkable with sagittal reconstruction. No bony defects of the hind foot to characterize fractures. Normal dome of talus. No fractures or dislocation. He dispensed two pairs of ortho shoes today, which was on the 7/10. What kind of shoes? Did not report. Her BP was 190 over 108, her first visit. It would be nice, I noted in this, if he followed up with the BP, because this is a serious matter at this point. The bill was a 99214. This note is not substantiated for a level 3 or level 4. On 8/26/19, the patient is wearing the ankle brace. It helps, but swells without brace. Objective, discuss subtalar fusion if brace stops working. No change in flatness of right foot. Plan, continue use of brace. I don't understand how a brace could stop the flatness of a foot. Repeated vitals again of 190 over 108. Discuss subtalar joint fusion if brace stops working. Minimal information present. No other exam finding documented. Again, 99213, not substantiated. 11-25-19, objective. Limb length discrepancy is measured left greater than right. Plantar fasciitis, neurologic neuritis plan, heel lift dispense, refer to a Dr. Lurie for EMGs. Again, that's all the information we have. Financials, that was billed as a 99213, again, not substantiated, poor documentation. On 1-13-20, neurology exam, evidence of a profound right tarsal tunnel syndrome affecting sensory and motor components without ongoing denervation. On 1-30-20, follow-up of nerve tests, objective, equinus position negative 10 degrees, positive 10 degrees right, plantar, just a second, I got lost, plantar, I'm sorry, just a second. Objective equinus, okay. Bilateral gastrocnemius equinus, neuritis, posterior tibial tendonitis, right, and pronation deformity. Plan recommended stay peg, gastrocnemius resection, and tarsal tunnel syndrome. Patient to return for H&P in 1 week. My notes are, the notes are very brief and objective. Diagnostic findings are stated without descriptive anatomical findings leading up to their rationale for the specific diagnosis. All this is present in the objective section of the exam. Equinus position negative 10 degrees, positive 10 degrees right. Don't understand what this means. Plantar fasciitis bilaterally. Gastrocnemius equinus. This is a new finding not mentioned in prior exams. The vitals are a duplicate of each exam. 190 over 108, this is a concern for me. A conclusion of neuritis is made. Observable clinical findings are absent. The plan of a stay peg is not recommended. The patient has extreme comorbidities, which should be addressed. No financials were submitted with this visit. On 2-26-20, the patient presented for H&P for right foot surgery. No BP was listed. Lortab 7.5, number 42, was dispensed. Consent forms were signed. This was listed as an H&P, a two-page report. First page is a duplicate of prior visits. Second page lists the vitals of temperature and pulse, exact same weight as all previous exam visits, which is impossible for a 310-pound patient to have the exact same weight since the summer. This is impossible for any patient to have the exact same weight every single visit. No blood pressure is listed. Where was the physical report? A level 99214 was billed. Documentation does not support. On 3620, pre-op H&P at Yuma Regional Medical Center, 3620, surgical tarsal tunnel syndrome right, anterior tarsal tunnel syndrome right, anterior tarsal tunnel release, dressed with 4-inch gauze, Curlex, and 4-inch ACE bandage. What kind of post-op ambulation aid was dispensed to this patient? Due to the patient's weight, you would not want the patient ambulating on this. And more support appears to be needed, I would assume. On 3920, post-op taking pain meds every 4 hours. For a patient to have surgery 3 days earlier and still be taking pain meds every 4 hours, this is of concern to me. A repeat of vitals from prior exams, again, 190 over 108. 3-17-20, post-op, medial incision tender, bloody today. Duplicate vitals now included same blood pressure. Patient walking in post-op wreath shoe, which is not supported. Dispensing arch pad to post-op shoe. RX, ammonium lactate, 12% lotion. Repeated vitals. Sutures removed. Sutures are removed on 3-20. Surgery is performed on 3-20. at 3:23, and surgery was performed on 3:06, approximately 2.5 weeks earlier. On 3:30 post-op, recommended laser surgery. She is having pain, repeated vitals. On 4:06 post-op, incision separating on medial side, 1 millimeter superficial, recommended laser treatment. 4:09 post-op, anterior incision at small split. Incision medial is split, more epidermis. Laser treatment, hematoma level. 4:13, 46 by 5, 12 by 5, incisions are closing. The measurements should be listed as to where they are and what 46 by 5 and 12 by 5 means according to this doctor. The wound should be described. Is there odor, pigment, coloration? Noted, is palpation soft or hard? I need description. On 4:17:20, laser treatment again on clindamycin. When was the clindamycin dispensed? Why was the clindamycin dispensed? Multiple wounds noted. Number one, right medial aspect tarsal tunnel incision, 3 centimeters by 3 millimeters into sub-Q. Wound number two, right anterior ankle incision, deep peroneal nerve, 1 centimeter by 2 centimeter sub-Q, both ulcers debrided, applied Minocca honey and bandage. On 4:21:20, another laser treatment. A second incision is noted on the right foot. I don't understand what this means. On 4:24:20, laser treatment again, 1.5 centimeters. Now it's good because it defines a measurement of centimeters or millimeters. Red granulation tissue, ankle, anterior, 1 millimeter by 4 millimeter with red granulation. Where is the incision? The ankle was never described from the surgery. Again, this is repeated. Financials, all the financial levels are not substantiated by the office notes. That's my conclusion is the patient had multiple comorbidities. The patient felt better with the ankle brace that was dispensed. I questioned the consideration of this patient for surgical procedures due to the multiple comorbidities. The patient, I don't see any lab pre-op. I don't see being worked up for a primary care physician. 190 over 108 blood pressure. The patient should have been referred back to the primary care physician to have this treated prior to any surgical intervention, no matter if her ankle is hurting her or not. If the brace was stabilizing her, I would have placed her in a brace for a longer period of time. At 310 pounds, I would have measured the circumference of her leg to make sure that her edema was controlled. Post-op, there was given a 4-inch ACE. A 4-inch ACE on a post-op wound would only really go around the ankle 2.5 times, which is not supportive for a patient of this size. And flat foot, tarsal tunnel surgery, I would have put it in something more stable, a soft cast with 3 to 5 ACE bandages minimal to wrap up the leg for support. There's a lot that could have been done for a patient to help prevent problems with such comorbidities. Number one, conservative care. That's my conclusion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Polakoff. I have no questions as you answered and presented this very well, and I will ask if and I'm in agreement with your opinion. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Polakoff?
Yes. So the new noting system that he started in April, you still find his notes deficient even after the new medical record system?
No, I'm not going to, I can't say that.
Okay. Dr. Foreman, again, these this review, this audit occurred, these patient time that Dr. Farrell was treating these patients is before that system was in effect. So this is documentation on the old system from which we had the prior case. Yeah. But I understand your frustration, like I've said. Okay. Do you have other questions?
Right. No, that was it. Thank you.
Dr. Yolano?
No, I have no further questions. Thank you, Dr. Farrell.
You're
welcome.
All right. So Dr. Farrell is present, so I will ask Dr. Farrell to let us to discuss these two patients that were audited, and then we can have the opportunity to ask him questions. Dr. Farrell.
Okay. I was under the understanding that this complaint was to show that I do EMG nerve conduction studies. And so they wanted me to send in all my tarsal tunnels and anterior tarsal tunnels showing that I do EMG nerve conduction studies on these patients. As far as GL, the patient had EMG nerve conduction studies, and I was worried that because the neurologist said it could be from radiculopathy from the lumbar area, but she also had problems up in her neck area, and since I was sending her for an MRI of her low back, I just included an MRI for her neck. She's going to go in through the MRI. You might as well get it all done at one time. And then I could refer her to the neurosurgeon, Dr. Hermanow, if I get a report on the neck being a problem. The EMG nerve conduction studies were kind of inconclusive on her, but the clinical exam showed that she had an L sign and entrapment of these nerves, and she had irritation of a plate that was elevated and it was causing spurring of bone. But the x-rays show that the fusion had taken from those plates that were put in years before. So as long as I was going to take in her surgery, we were going to take the plate out with the screws and do the tarsal tunnel and anterior tarsal tunnel. The patient improved with the surgery. On Evelyn, on EM, she had come to me the ER sent her to me as a patient and said that she had a calcaneal fracture. X-rays did not show the calcaneal fracture. I believe I did a CAT scan of the bone structures, and it also showed a good clean subtalar joint and no fractures. She did have pain in the subtalar joint, but with 360 pounds on this area, she pronates a lot, and she had a positive Tenel sign in her tibial nerve and anterior ankle on the deep peroneal nerve. I believe I tried injections into her. I usually use Marcaine and Kenalog, about 10 milligrams of Kenalog in my injections. They seem to relieve her pain temporarily, but with the way she is, she requested something more permanent. I do believe I have some labs in here. When I did her H&P, But the patient did heal. I use a class 4 laser in my office. Several doctors, like from Atlanta, had the same laser that they use for ulcer care, and use a hematoma level from this class 4 laser. It's not a cold laser. It's not truly a hot laser, but it does take down inflammation and help heal up my ulcerations better and faster. So both these patients improved with their surgery. Evelyn still has some subtalar joint pain. We're going to try a different type of brace called the Taco brace coming up. That will help her. It goes outside her shoe, and that might stabilize her a little bit more. Any questions?
Your remark, Dr. Farrell, about what this audit was about, I will read that so that everybody remembers and isn't aware on the consent agreement. Reads like this: the board expressed concerns about the respondent's diagnosis of a nerve entrapment in MO after a second surgery and questioned the respondent's decision to perform two additional surgeries, including one for a nerve release without ordering or performing a CT or an MRI, a nerve conduction study, or a consult with a specialist. So that is correct. But when we're looking at these, that does not limit the investigator or the board members from having concerns raised in other areas. So that would go along with the line of questioning that we're doing here. So we're not off base here with doing so. I noticed, Dr. Farrell, that you did the HMP through the Yuma Medical Center portal. And so it was like it was dictated on the 27th of February of 20. You signed it at the hospital on March the 6th at, 6:51 in the morning. And I noticed there's a lot of pre-populated info on there, because it particularly, with the actual PE exam, there's information that was there that wasn't in other notes that you had in your office. And Dr. Polakoff had already, indicated that there was no surgical clearance from and the primary care, nothing on the anesthesia record. So, again, I know this is before the time of conversion on your EMR system, but and I also noticed on these two patients, that GL and EM, on your physical examination, pre-op physical examination, that I'll go back. When we talked back in, it was January, when we were reviewing another audit case then, that there was a patient by the initials of MC. Yes, this was at the 22nd of January meeting, that you had indicated, and we saw on the PE, that a breast exam had been performed and that you had used the 99215 code. That was the question we had there. Then again, when I looked at your PEs on these two individuals, no breast exam was performed. So what was the difference between doing that exam at that time, but not on these other two patients?
I believe I did the breast exam, I just didn't document it.
And at that same meeting back on January 22nd, you also indicated that you didn't perform rectals or those other exams. So I just wanted to double check that because, like I said, I had noticed it was on there, so I thought, well, maybe you decided not to do those anymore, but you have just indicated that you probably still did, but just didn't document it. And during a patient, get the right one here. For the time frame for, you know, how much, you know, conservative care time that was on, okay, on EM. Initial visit being 6/4 of 19 and surgery date of 3/6 of 20. So you had 9 months, and I know I did read, obviously, that you had done some conservative management. But again, with that, this patient's weight and her comorbidities, do you think that 9 months was a long enough time for conservative management to have been tried? And I would like to know, was there any attempt at weight loss or smoking cessation in the patient before the surgical procedure?
I believe there was.
Whoever just came on the line, we're getting some back noise. Could you please mute your phone? Thank you. Please, Dr. Farrell, go ahead.
I believe there was, and that's, you know, I didn't feel good about this person's weight, but with her not really doing much about her weight, not following her doctor's orders as well as I had hoped, she still had this pain. And so I would like to have put something more substantial on her, like a cast or something, but she is very large. And there's two reasons. One, her being too large, and two, there's theories that after doing a tarsal tunnel release that doing motion through this will help glide the tendons and glide the nerves so they don't get as much scar tissue. Okay? And so I felt doing that instead of immobilizing her and getting scar tissue that I would... She could put weight on this, but only in the post-op shoe, where it wasn't bending her toes and everything. This seemed to work for her. She didn't get scarred in, and she did break. She didn't heal of her skin as fast as you would expect on a normal weighted person, but she did heal up eventually.
Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano, do you have questions for Dr. Farrell?
I don't.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Farrell. This is Dr. Ilano. I got a question for you. Do you do the EMG studies in your office?
No, I send them to a neurologist.
Okay. And you just... put his findings in your notes, whatever the findings are.
Correct.
Okay. And several patients, you have leg length discrepancies. How come you don't mention the length or the discrepancy on each leg?
I'll start to do that. Most of the time, it's a quarter of an inch. I check the hip height, the anterior superior iliac spines, and I look across the... cross their hips to see when I put a lift underneath. 90% of these are a quarter of an inch. And I'll start documenting, you know.
Sure. That would be helpful. I saw on your notes that you you divided calluses and nails, but you didn't mention it in your notes. That would be helpful also if you put that in your notes, that they had calluses where...
Okay.
Any other questions, gentlemen?
No, that's good.
Okay, thank you. At this time, I'd like to go into executive session for purposes of legal advice. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Do I have both ayes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Aye.
Any opposed? So moved. Okay, so everyone can just remain on the line and we will be back.
Yeah, and Dr. Foreman, Dr. Yolano, this is Heather. Seamus and I will call you on your cell phones if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, sounds good.
At 9:27, we'll go back on open session record. All right, so thanks to Dr. Polakoff and Dr. Farrell for their participation. And seeing what, you know, questions that have been raised today and discussion that we have had, it's my opinion that we continue the audit for a period of time. And does anyone have any recommendation or opinion on how many more audits should be done to make a determination on this file?
I would say three more.
Dr. Yolano, your opinion?
Sure. Three would be good. I'll have a good idea with three people.
Okay. With the same protocol that has been set in the past. You don't have any. Did you want to change any of the procedure? We'll just keep it the same. Does that sound fair? Applicable?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So then I'll go ahead and make a motion to continue this audit in the interim consent agreement for case 18-08-C to evaluate three additional surgical patients plan to undergo kind of nerve decompression surgery. Do I have a second?
Second it.
Any further discussion? All in favor? Do you want a voice vote on this?
Aye.
Do you want? We're going to do a voice
vote.
Okay, sorry, guys. We'll go back and do a voice vote on that. Dr. Yolano?
Aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. We have no dissent. So moved. So then we will continue in that manner. And Dr. Farrell, continue work with Heather and Dr. Polakoff on this. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Safe week.
You too. All right, we will move forward with B, the investigation files, of which we have two. Heather, are we needing to proceed with the second one because of time with the council that's involved?
I believe that the attorney has joined the conference call. Can I confirm as to whether or not Robin Burgess is on the conference call?
Yes, I am. I am. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Dr. Hidalgo is not present, but represented by his counsel, Robin. Did we say Burgess? Is that correct, ma'am?
It is, yes. It's Robin Burgess, and I apologize. Dr. Holgado was not able to attend this morning, but given the investigators and the consultants' report, I'm appearing in case there's any issues or questions that I can help answer.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Saunders, are you there, our investigator?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Saunders. Okay, so we will go ahead then with number two. The complaint number is 20-08-C, which is Ronald Hidalgo, DPM. And we do not have a complainant on the line, Heather. Okay. So, Dr. Saunders, if you would please proceed with your report.
Sure. I'll try and make this one quick for you guys. I did speak with the complainant, JT. I spoke with him regarding his concerns, and I'll just kind of summarize them now. He felt like he was misdiagnosed, that the doctor in question did not really address a potential injury to his ankle at the time, which delayed his healing. He felt like he was prematurely allowed to kind of ambulate on his foot, walking too early, which caused him a delay in healing. And then after he had sought another opinion, he was upset that he was not initially offered a surgical option to help cure his problem. Notes were provided by Dr. Hidalgo. They're a little complicated going through that banner system, but it seems that the patient was seen three times. Initially seen in the ER, and then Dr. Hidalgo had seen him three times. Chart notes were in there. Summarizing those for everybody, it looks like Dr. Hidalgo initially saw the patient a couple days after the patient had a fall, injured himself, was seen in the emergency room for a fractured calcaneus, as well as for an ankle injury. And the ankle injury goes kind of back and forth as kind of a subservient to the calcaneal fracture. ER initially does show a flex fracture, and I did identify that on the radiographs myself. Initial report does focus primarily to the calcaneus. There is really an omission in the chart notes regarding the left ankle injury and focus mostly on the calcaneus for the chart. There is mention initially of surgical intervention if needed to heal the fracture, so that was sort of addressed. And the chart notes going through to three visits do show clearly a non-weight-bearing course, 7 to 8 weeks. Patient was put on Medrol Dospac. It appeared twice. Patient was a smoker going through the charts. And as the going through the three visits, there's no real clear course for a progression from the cam boot to a sneaker as the patient was immobilized the entire time. The doctor does not truly address the ankle injury itself, noting that motion is intact. Doesn't really address it in his assessment and plan, but I do think that initially there was about a 1 millimeter flex fracture. Going back and forth with the radiographs that he ordered, that was healed and not even mentioned by the radiologist on future exams. I think that the patient was fully immobilized during the entire time. Patient was not necessarily directly offered a surgical intervention where it was reviewed, but the doctor did mention that surgical intervention could be used if necessary. I don't know the exact conversation that would be for him to have with his patients for us to discuss. But this was a 68-year-old elderly man with a history of smoking. And, you know, conservative care, I think, is certainly reasonable. When I went through the allegations, I don't have fault with any of the doctor's care. The misdiagnosis of an ankle injury, I think the overall trauma and immobilization of his treatment is consistent with the conservative therapy, though it wasn't necessarily addressed in the chart notes. I think that a immobilization is standard enough for a treatment of care for that. In regards to an early ambulation, the patient was fully immobilized for 8 weeks. The radiographs on follow-up show that it was consolidating. And then there is a mention that the notes, surgical intervention wasn't really truly discussed. I wasn't there for the conversation he had initially with him. He does make notion that surgical intervention and bone stimulation is an option. I would assume that he had a conversation with the patient that he didn't recommend it as, and that's probably a physician interpretation. The radiographs do show a comminuted, you know, typical intra-articular calcaneal fracture. I think conservative or surgical intervention is depends on the physician in their hands, but I think the care was appropriate at this point. I have a little concern that the patient was given steroids a couple times. I think that slows down healings, in my opinion. There wasn't a clear progression when the patient was transferred from ambulation at week 7-8, going back to a sneaker. Patient did call up in the future upon discharge for a physical therapy request. And after the third visit, there was no future follow-up or care plan addressed. And that was really the only concern I have with the matter, is the patient was just after week 3, all right, go back to a shoe and good luck kind of a deal. Doctor's not available to ask for that. Outside of that, I really don't have problems with the care. And the patient did subsequently go to physical therapy. He did see another physician, and a few months later, seems to be doing just fine. I think that's standard of care with a calcaneal fracture, and you know, they're tough injuries to heal sometimes. That was really all I got.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Was there any document, would you have sent him to physical therapy a little sooner before he was weight-bearing?
You know, I think in my case, the way I would manage this is I would have had a conversation with the patient at some point saying, hey, if you would like to go to physical therapy, go. I think that the timeline was great. I think the patient had to call back up saying, hey, I'm not progressing like I would like to. Can I go to physical therapy? And that's what was documented. The patient called in for it. And the doctor had no problems, I think, and referred him to physical therapy. It just seems like on the last visit, which was like seven, 8 weeks into it, it says, start walking with your cam boot, and that was kind of it.
Right. Thank you.
Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Dr. Saunders, again, you feel like this falls within the standard of care of the community?
I don't have a problem. The patient was immobilized for 8 weeks. You know, that's standard. Radiographs were showing signs of healing. He started them off in a cam boot. I think that's appropriate.
Okay. I have no further question. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Saunders, I also question, documentation. I always think when good documentation can prevent a lot of problems, and particularly with good and having good communication skills with one's patients. I also, have questions with using steroids when you've got somebody who's already on chronic steroid use for, asthma. You've got a smoker. You know, those kind of things obviously decrease healing. I do agree that care was within the standard. And we all kind of realize and know that there's a lot of pain and disability associated with calcaneal fractures, and that they can take, you know, up to a year's time to heal. And and I also think sometimes you get athletic patients who get a little bit antsy and they want to get back to their sport, and that can obviously be an aggravating factor. And the fact that the complainant made the decision to go elsewhere. And so then obviously Dr. Hidalgo was not given an opportunity to follow up, because with this person, and seeing his previous treatment, obviously I feel that he would have continued to treat this patient within the standard of care to deal with the issues that the complainant is saying that he that occurred after he left Dr. Hidalgo's care. That is how I feel about this right now. But we have the doctor's counsel on the line, so I would appreciate, and I know everyone has read Ms. Burgess's letter that was presented in our files, so I would ask Ms. Burgess if she could give us a summary, and then if anyone has questions that they would like to ask her, that can happen. So, Ms. Burgess.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief. I think that Dr. Sanders has summarized in general the visits. Dr. Holgado saw this patient on three different occasions over the course of about the first 7 weeks after the patient's injury. He did x-rays, evaluated the healing, saw the resolution of some of the issues that were going on, did at the beginning during the first visit go through various options for treatment. But at the time, it was 2 days after the original injury, and the doctor recommended conservative treatment and see where things go. And if things didn't seem to be healing appropriately, they could move into more aggressive forms of treatment or alternate forms of treatment. The patient never raised those issues again. The doctor was pursuing a fairly standard and conservative form of therapy. They had discussed physical therapy once the patient was closer to weight bearing. And so after that last visit, when the patient did start to weight bear again, he called and asked for that physical therapy referral that had been part of the original discussion. Unfortunately, as you know, Dr. Holgado was deprived of the opportunity to see how the patient was progressing at that point in time because the patient chose not to return to his office and he went elsewhere. Dr. Holgado feels very strongly that had the patient come back, they would have continued to dialogue about the level of healing. He probably would have been taking additional x-ray studies to see where things stood, and if there was clearly a problem with the healing, they would have moved to other options if needed and if warranted. But I think that Dr. Holgado would agree that this was a fairly impatient patient. He was quite physically active and athletic despite being a smoker with some asthma issues. And so the patient did appear to sort of want a faster course after the original 8 weeks had passed. And again, if Dr. Holgado had been involved with the patient's care at that point in time, they would have had the opportunity to discuss how to proceed and what other next steps might be warranted. Dr. Holgado never got that opportunity. So I think, you know, his sense here is that based on the information he had, based on the visits he had, the studies he had, the care was reasonable and appropriate. And if the patient had come back, he doesn't know where they would have gone, and he frankly does not know at this point, because we do not have subsequent records, what may have happened with the patient, but it does not appear he underwent any kind of surgical intervention, even with his new doctor. And, you know, he certainly hopes that this patient is back to being physically active as he had been prior to this injury, understanding that this is an injury that can take a while to heal and can cause limitations in a patient even after healing.
My only comment for that, and this should get back to the doctor, is that, you know, when he last saw him on 5/21, he did not make a follow-up appointment. And when the patient called back in June to ask for physical therapy, he did not schedule a follow-up appointment. So, you know, I think I would have at that point to see anything else I could do for the patient, maybe orthotics or other care that he got from the other physician. Again, I don't think that the standard was breached at this point, but that would be a comment back to the doctor that he could at least offer an appointment.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions for counsel?
No, I don't.
No questions for me, and thank you.
All right. So, as this is an initial review on this, and I believe everybody seems to be in agreement that community standard of care, the care that the complainant received was within the community standard of care, but there have been concerns raised regarding the documentation, particularly when it came to the avulsion fracture that was not directly or noted in documentation, and the question of using a medrol dose pack when you've already got a patient who's got a fracture, you know, you think of bone healing, a smoker, and as Dr. Sunners just mentioned about, you know, when a patient calls, and I believe that patient had also called and was given at one point in time some ibuprofen too, and without seeing a patient, I think that, you know, kind of saying, you know, we need to see you before we go any further, you know, and then maybe the patient could have maybe been retained. You know, that's, who knows, we weren't there. So I'm thinking, you know, is this enough of a caveat to place, and that the council can talk to the, Dr. Hidalgo about that, or do you all feel that maybe issuing a letter of concern regarding these concerns is appropriate? Dr. Yolanda,
I feel
Dr.
just
Thurman?
Talking to the doctor.
I second that.
I would feel just talking to the doctor about it. I don't feel this merits a letter of concern.
Dr. Yolanda, you were saying?
Yeah. He performed the standard of care. I don't think a letter of concern would be needed. Just a letter informing him out of our findings would be sufficient for me.
Okay. All right. Well, I know the physician also has the opportunity to listen to the meeting on our website, and of course his attorney is present and can transfer that information and concern to him. So, seeing, I will make a motion to dismiss case 20-08-C, seeing that there were no violations of state statutes.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Seconded.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Or no opposition? So moved. Thank you very much. And are we okay? Everybody can move on. There's no break time. Anybody need a break for anything? Okay, well, let's move on then to our next investigation file, which is complaint number 20-04-C, is Dr. Erica Huston, the DPM. Her counsel, Mr. Bruce Crawford, is also present telephonically. And this case was investigated by Dr. Polakoff. So I will ask Dr. Polakoff to please give her report.
Good morning, Board. This is Dr. Polakoff for 2004C, Erica Huston. The complainant is a DR who submitted a complaint alleging a complication with his toe after Dr. Huston treated him in her office and performed surgery on him. There are two allegations in this. Number one, harm to the patient or failure to review chart for the vascular findings, which required surgical intervention. And allegation number two, billing concerns of ENM code 99213, and then use of the modifier 25, which was not present. In summary of the complaint, the patient was seen by a nurse practitioner at a Tucson Medical Center for wound healing. The nurse practitioner gave an exceptional review, and on the 6/14/2019 visit, she noted that the patient had neuropathic ulcer of the toe left and neuropathic ulcer of the right heel with fat layer exposed. She did order at that time an arterial studies, ABI, right lower extremity for decreased perception of circulation. The patient did have an arterial Doppler performed on 6/17, 3 days later. which showed calcification of bilateral common femoral and superficial femoral artery with less than 50% stenosis. Greater than 50% stenosis, the proximal posterior tibial artery of the right side. On 6/18/2019, the x-ray which the nurse practitioner ordered showed no definitive radiographic evidence of bony osteomyelitis. The patient then saw Dr. Houston on 6/18/19 for her initial evaluation. She notes that distal pulses were intact. The heel ulcer is undermining laterally and is slightly boggy or puffy on the right. She notes the size and surface margins of the ulcer. Again, the patient was seen on 6/25. The patient reviewed shoe uncomfortable, which the patient was given to off-weight load the ulcer. The ulcer was again debrided, wound length measured. Duplicate visits of 7/2/19, pulses intact were reported. On 7/8/2019, surgery was performed, a non-painful ulcer, right foot. The patient was neuropathic, and hair growth was absent, no edema, temperature within normal limits. The patient was noted to have pulses of the posterior tibial plus 2 over 4 bilateral and DP plus 2 over 4 bilateral. The right wound heel was cavernous. Wound base was red and beefy. The patient had a tenotomy performed to the fourth toe left foot, which was starting to have an ulcer, which helped resolve this area. On 7/16, a full thickness ulcer, the right heel was still present. All this time she was stating in her notes, follow up on arterial studies. The doctor had not noted that the arterial studies were already in the chart at this time, and the patient had been seeing the doctor for almost a month. Four visits were seen. 7/23, again seen. 7/30, the arterial Doppler was not observed in the chart or noted on. On 8/6/2019, debridement of the wound. It also notes for the first time that topical lidocaine was used for anesthesia. The patient was neuropathic. He had symptoms, he states, was typical of a diabetic. He had his kidney removed. He had hair loss to his legs, nail changes, and developed ulcers for bilateral feet because he states he could not feel anything. So I don't understand why all of a sudden that the topical lidocaine was needed for anesthesia, which then continued in all her reports. There on 8/20/2019, there was a new wound noted to the second toe, which was debrided full thickness. It continued with the same debridement technique. Pulses were intact. There was a lot of carryover each visit of the documentation. So I don't know what was new information except for the measurements of the wound. The 9/10/2019, the wound length starts to enlarge for the heel, continues through to 9/26/19. The patient had a H&P by a resident, which noted 1+ edema, non-pitting, and the resident notes the DP and PT pulses were palpable. On 9/26/19, the same date, surgery was performed for a DIPJ arthroplasty of the left second toe, excisional debridement of the right heel, and excisional debridement of all non-viable soft tissue to the level of, including subcutaneous fascia of the distal tip of the left second toe. measuring approximately 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. On 11-1-2019, the patient appears to be doing well with the ulcer, still present, subcutaneous necrotic slough tissue less than 20 centimeters. The patient recommended non-weight-bearing, continued, and she had concerns about the patient being weight-bearing due to his real estate job. On 10-8-2019, the patient was advised that he needs more surgery to debride the ulcer of the right heel, which was increasing. On 10-28-19, this was the first time x-rays were taken since the original 6-18-2019 visit, and an MRI was ordered for the area to rule out osteomyelitis for concerns of the wound not healing. There was no evidence of osteomyelitis according to the MRI. On 10-29-19, the full-thickness ulcer extending through the fat layers progressing. At that time, she recommended a vascular consult. On 11-5-2019, the full-thickness ulceration was at its worst. MRI reported for osteomyelitis. The patient was referred to Dr. Levor for a vascular consult. The patient was seen on 11-12-19 and was immediately recommended for an angioplasty ASAP to provide circulation to the right extremity. The posterior tibial was almost 100% blocked. The patient progressed with the vascular surgeon, who also debrided the heel, and according to the operative report, debrided the heel and shifted the plantar fascial band and removed a lot of the necrotic fat pad to allow the ulcer to heal. The ulcer was slowly making progress. Another vascular surgery was required, and the patient went on to healing to the last note of the ulcer measuring only 0.5 centimeter with a callus. Dr. Houston, in her report to the board, noted that DR was seen at the TMC Wound Care Center from 6-18-19 to 11-5-19. During the initial visit, the doctor noted that he did have palpable pulses. The patient the doctor was waiting for the arterial study to be returned in the notes, but she did not see the notes, and she was not aware that the report had already been filed in the TMC medical records, according to her chart from 6-20-19, but she was not aware of this. The doctor went on to continue to treat the patient, and she states that the report of the ABI notes presence of greater than 50% stenosis to the right posterior tibial artery, and ABIs were 0.7 bilaterally, all signs of moderate PAD. According to the vascular report, it's mild to moderate PAD. The doctor demonstrated excellent, DR, who's the patient, demonstrated excellent healing after the left foot surgical procedure for the fourth toe. And the second toe, for the hammer toe, the patient, according to the doctor's notes, was healing with the ulcer progressing slightly worse. The MRI showed no signs of osteomyelitis, as I stated before. And the doctor states that it was an oversight to which she is sure to make further attention in the future so that no chart oversights are missed. The unusual item in this report is that the Tucson Medical Center underwent a peer review, and during the peer review, the temporary director of the Tucson Medical Center stated that to the patient that there was a problem, there was an omission, and that they are going to learn from this omission. In the financials, the initial office visit of the 99203 was an evaluation and management. This cannot be substantiated with the records, even though the records are multiple pages, because if it was an evaluation and management, the chart was not evaluated on 6/18 completely for the vascular study, which showed that it was ordered, and the radiology study was ordered, but this was also not reported in Dr. Houston's report. On 6/25/19, the vascular study was already in the file, and the doctor had a 99213 evaluation and management, but the chart was not evaluated because at that time the vascular study was present, which was not reported by Dr. Houston or followed up by Dr. Houston. My questions are concerns with Dr. Houston's report for a number of issues. One is, were the x-rays, the only x-rays I show in the chart, were ordered from the nurse practitioner and were done on 6/18, 2019. The ulcer was progressing, but there were no other further x-rays to follow up the heel, which was progressing. There were no labs ordered. The patient was extremely neuropathic. There were no blood glucoses to follow. He was not a diabetic, but there were no labs for vascular follow-up. There was no triglyceride for follow-up. There was no blood glucose. There were no blood cultures. There were no lab cultures. There were no tissue biopsies from surgery. There were no consults for vascular or neurological until the patient was getting worse and the patient was asking the doctor, what do we do now? The use of topical lidocaine, I don't understand in this circumstance. And again, I mentioned the biopsy of the wound. Because of these concerns, I have substantiated both, number one, allegation of harm to the patient for failure to review chart for vascular findings, and allegation number two, for billing concerns of the E&M management code, which should not have been billed with a debridement code. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Polkoff. And I forgot to mention that we do have the complainant on the line. I apologize, DR. Now we'll take the opportunity to ask Dr. Polkoff questions, and then, DR, we can have you read your statement that you had submitted previously to Ms. Broaddus at the board. So who has questions for Dr. Polkoff?
This is Dr. Foreman. I have a question. Based upon the billing records, the only thing that should have been, based upon the documentations, the only thing that should have been billed was the 11042 on most of those visits. Is that correct, in your opinion?
Correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
Okay. That's all the questions I have for Dr.
Thank you. Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions for Dr. Polkoff?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Polkoff. I got a question for you. In reviewing her medical records, the nurse practitioner, Kelly Keel, on her notes, she said she will discuss with her. Was that to discuss the findings of the ABI with Dr. Houston?
And you're asking me she discussed that? Is that the question?
Yes. Did you ever, in your investigation, did the nurse practitioner ever relate any of the findings to Dr. Houston?
The nurse practitioner saw the patient initially on, just a second, one moment, please. on just one second. Yes, here it is. The nurse practitioner saw the patient on 6/14. The vascular studies were performed on 6/17. At that, between those two times, the patient was referred to Dr. Houston, and Dr. Houston saw the patient initially on 6/18. The vascular studies were performed on 6/17, and it was scanned into the chart on 6/20.
Okay, because this is what I'm reading this. Arterial studies decreased ABI, right lower extremity, and it, right the line right before that, it says, we'll discuss with her. I was wondering if you had a chance to see if it was discussed with Dr. Houston and Kelly.
Well, at that point, the patient was referred to Dr. Houston by the nurse practitioner, and in her note, for the purpose of referral, was to off-weight load the extremity.
Okay. But as far as discussion about the ABI, they didn't talk about it, or they did?
Well, no, doctor, at that point, I believe the nurse practitioner left to go to Dr. Lavore's practice.
Okay.
That would, Dr. Ilano, that would be a very good question for Dr. Yeah. Huston, so ask her.
Okay. Then I'll defer that question then. At this point, I have no further questions.
Okay. Dr. Polakoff, I thank you for the very detailed summary. I do, let me see, where are my questions here? So you and there were you had no X-rays to review and there were no lab tests to review, correct?
That is correct.
Just a second here. Oh yes, on the billing question. So. Obviously, the initial E&M code is appropriate with the 25 modifier. When I was looking at the HCPA forms on the billing, that each visit where the debridement occurred, codes were used the L97.412, which is a non-pressure chronic ulcer of the right heel and midfoot with fat layer exposed. Then the other code used was the L97.522, non-pressure chronic ulcer over the other part of the left foot with fat layer exposed. So as far as with the code that was used and attached to the 99213 was the L97.412, which would have been the right heel ulcer, and then the debridement was attached to the left foot ulcer, which was the toe. And by the definition of a 11042, there's, I believe it's, what is it, 20, what the area of debridement total is. So it appears to me that the heel ulcer obviously was used as the diagnosis for the 99213, but the debriding code is actually both of those ulcers were debrided. So again, that's inappropriate to bill for that 99213 when you're just doing the debridement, and using that heel ulcer code is inappropriate.
Correct.
Thank you. All right. Any further questions for Dr. Polakoff at this time? Okay, thank you. Okay, sir, we remember to use your initials DR. So I know you presented a summary. So if you want to just read that, that would be perfect.
Madam Chairman, members of the board, thank you for this opportunity. As you are aware from my initial complaint and information gathered by your investigator, Dr. Perlikoff, This situation began over a year ago at the wound care center operated by Tucson Medical Center. While the wound on the heel of my right foot has finally healed, there are other concerns that have presented themselves that this wound was simply a symptom of. As you should be aware, a Doppler study of my lower legs was ordered by the family nurse practitioner, Kelly Keel, whom I saw initially at the center. While I assume Dr. Houston was made aware of the contents of the study, I personally did not learn of the contents until 5 months later when I was referred to a vascular surgeon, Michael Labor. During my first appointment, Dr. Labor started using a handheld device to gauge blood flow in my right leg at the ankle. Trying to save time and effort, I suggested that there had been a study conducted 5 months earlier at his office, as the family nurse practitioner, Kelly Keel, was affiliated with his practice. His assistant located the study results in the office computer. His initial reaction was that I needed to see a cardiologist. I was eventually able to do so. To combat high cholesterol, I am now taking a statin drug. Recently, I was placed on a monitor to determine the level of atrial fibrillation that I have. And as I wrote this, I had added two additional drugs to the pills that I take daily. I've now been prescribed a third one to try and combat the fibrillation issue. I will also have an echocardiogram later this month. My cardiologist is concerned about possible strokes. The Doppler study from June 2019 was a valuable clue to other potential health issues. Apparently, it was either ignored or was not understood by Dr. Houston. I understand Tucson Medical Center, as Dr. Polacroft mentioned, has taken corrective actions after I called the situation to the attention of the chief executive officer. While the primary wound issue on the heel of my right, was on the heel of my right foot, I did have wounds, as was mentioned, on the second and fourth toes of my left foot. The hammer toe issues with the fourth toe was resolved by a ligament cut at Dr. Houston's private office. The second toe was a different situation. She diagnosed the last joint before the nail was frozen due to arthritis. She suggested it be removed and assured me the toe would look no different. I have attached a picture which demonstrates that it does indeed look different. It was curled around the third toe and will not straighten even with manipulation. It remains somewhat painful. Hopefully you received that picture. I am not trying to be punitive by bringing this complaint, but a review of the timeline will demonstrate that some corrections need to be made. I initially lost 5 months and underwent surgery on both feet by Dr. Houston before my referral to Dr. Labor. It took another 8 months before I could attempt to resurrect my real estate business, as I was not able to walk and forced to use a knee scooter to get around. I still have my left foot to deal with and my cardiovascular problems to address. If I understand your website correctly, Dr. Houston's license is scheduled for renewal this month. I'm not certain that is a good idea. If her license is renewed, there should be severe restrictions and requirements she should meet before being allowed unrestricted practice. It would be my privilege to address any questions that the board might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DR, for your summary. I do have a couple questions for you, sir. With your right heel, do you have any deformity of your heel? Is the heel turned in or out when you walk?
That I couldn't answer with any definitive description. The only deformity there is that there is a difference in the texture of the skin at the area of the wound. And as I mentioned on my initial complaint to the board, while I have neuropathy, it's not as a result of diabetes. It's a result of operation I had at age 16, some 51 years ago, when I had a benign tumor inside the spinal column, and they had to cut an S1 root as a preventative to keep it from growing back and causing further issues. So the neuropathy has progressed gradually over the years, and that's, you know, the luck of the draw, I guess.
Yes, I noticed that. Thank you, though, for reminding us of that. Is there, has there been any concern now that you've seen the cardiologist of any type 2 diabetes with your history?
No concern has been mentioned. I've always been borderline diabetic, but when I was urged and was able to lose some weight about 3 or 4 years ago, the borderline situation with diabetes has gone away, and I'm no longer considered a candidate for diabetes, at least at this point in time. Obviously, that could change in the future.
Thank you. Another question, sir. Prior to you developing, you know, with the heel ulcer, were you able to walk and not experience pain in your calf, or did you, or if you were walking, that, geez, after a couple blocks, you had pain in your calf and you had to stop or anything?
There was no pain, doctor, in my calf area. If there was any discomfort, it was in my foot. And I've, several years ago, prior to seeing Dr. Houston and Ms. Keel at the Wound Care Center, I had had a similar wound develop and was treated at University Medical Center, and I don't remember the name of the podiatrist there, simply because he was kind of an arrogant individual who kind of, you know, just left me to my own devices, and I finally, you know, it did heal over, but probably didn't heal properly at that particular point in time, and this particular wound redeveloped when I was walking in my backyard, which, as most people in Arizona have, instead of grass, they have rocks, and I was walking in my Crocs, and a stone got between the my heel and the surface of the Croc, and opened the wound, and I probably should have sought medical treatment earlier, but I didn't come to the wound care center until June, and the rest, as you know, is history.
So have you heard the term intermittent claudication? Has anybody ever described that to you, the vascular surgeon or your cardiologist?
Not that I recall, doctor.
Okay. And that was the reason I asked you about, did you have calf pain when you walked that was relieved by you resting? That's called intermittent claudication, where it's a question that should be asked to determine, you know, if the possibility that someone has some blood flow problems. So I was just had looked and wanted to know if you were ever asked that question by any of the by Dr. Houston, or if you had been asked that by the nurse practitioner, the vascular surgeon. So that was the reason I asked that. I will ask you any of
no,
my... Oh, pardon me, please. Go ahead.
And you should also know, and I think I told Dr. Prolikoff this, but I will remind you and the members of the board, that as a result of my surgery when I was age 16, in the cutting of that S1 root, my right leg is much smaller in circumference and has some atrophy, as opposed to my left leg, which is much larger in circumference, and it it was it and continues to be my stronger of my two legs. But no, the atrial claudication, that was never mentioned, discussed, or as you know, I wasn't even informed of the results of the Doppler study that was conducted in June of 2019 until I saw Dr. Lavore in November of 2019.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ulano, do you have any questions for DR?
I have a question. So no one from the family practice got back to you with that Doppler results either?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. That was the question I had. Thank you.
Dr. Ulano?
Hi, DR. This is Dr. Ulano. I've got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
You had two prior heel ulcers. Any more ulcers prior to this?
I had one prior heel ulcer. It was somewhere in the area of 2014, I think, 2013, 2014. And I sought treatment at University Medical Center, which is now Banner University Medical Center, because my PCP that I was seeing at the time referred me there. And the podiatrist, and for the life of me, I can't think of his name because he was a very forgettable individual because of his arrogance, and that's just my description of him. But in any event, I just had the one prior situation, and it did heal, and I thought everything was good until this developed in 2019.
How long did the first ulcer take to heal?
About 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
That's okay. My recollection. And it could be longer.
And how did you...
Who knows? I went on a weekly basis, and they debrided it and filled it with medication, bandaged it up, and had me come back a week later.
Okay. Any other history of... healing wounds in your body or anything like that?
No, just, you know, normal bumps and scrapes. If I'm doing a project, a woodworking project or something like that, sometimes I'll get cuts on my hands, but they heal fairly quickly, that type of thing.
Okay. I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Now we have Dr. Huston on the line as well as her counsel, Mr. Bruce Crawford. So I would ask Dr. Huston to give us a summary from her viewpoint.
Well, Dr. Dr. Campbell, this is Bruce Crawford. Can I just make a couple of comments?
Certainly.
And then we can have Dr. Huston go ahead. Thank you. I appreciate it very much. First off, when we received the investigation report and Dr. Polakoff raised the issue about a modifier not being present, Dr. Huston contacted her billing person about that and found out that those claim forms still existed. So... she didn't know that at the time, so she went and requested those, and that's why we provided those. And so my understanding of where we're at on this is there's two allegations in this case. One is the issue about reviewing the vascular findings, the Doppler, and then the second one is this issue about a 25 modifier not being present. So, the billing issue, there's been additional comments made here about other codes, et cetera. The doctor has not been aware of those concerns and didn't respond to those, but hopefully she can do that today. And then the first allegation about the vascular, the honest answer here is the doctor doesn't recall the specific circumstances. The nurse practitioner ordered the study. Dr. Huston has no recollection that the nurse practitioner told her about the results, and she simply does not recall what the circumstances were about the report. So she's not going to sit here and make something up when she simply doesn't recall the situation. In terms of the other various issues that Dr. Polakoff has raised, you know, those are medical things that I think the doctor should respond to. So I think she can give you a summary of her care, and I think she can try as best she can today to refer or to respond to whatever issues have been raised, including some of the new issues. So I'll go ahead and moot my end here so we don't get feedback, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Okay, Dr. Houston here. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Yolano and Dr. Foreman, can you hear?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, I can. Hi, Dr. Houston.
Hi. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I did provide a summary, but I'll go ahead and do that again and try to answer Dr. Polakoff's questions as well. So as we're aware, I started seeing DR at the TNC Wound Care Center in June of 2019. He was referred to me for treatment of both the right heel and the left fourth toe ulcers. The fourth toe ulcer was successfully resolved by the flexor tenotomy I performed in my office. We know that. I will comment that I would not operate on anyone if I suspected vascular compromise. So I believe the documentation of the patient having palpable pulses bilaterally is accurate. I would have verified that. And as you mentioned, I don't recall the specifics regarding the vascular studies that Kelly ordered, and not going to make anything up. Just I understand my notes say that I should follow up on them, and I didn't. Kelly did not call me to discuss them as her note indicated she would. And this is all just unfortunate oversight in the documentation. And as I did mention, and as Judy Rich mentioned, we would work to rectify this oversight. The way the Wound Care Center operates can be very inefficient and inconvenient. There's only one computer in each exam room, and that's reserved for the nurse case manager. And I attempted to get my medical assistant credentialed to be a scribe for me at the Wound Care Center to assist with documentation. And then COVID hit and haven't been able to do that. But I have been carrying around a personal computer that has helped me improve medical review. The nurse case manager documents everything ordered, everything, all the results that we're expecting, and we go over that every week in huddle before seeing the patients for the Wound Care Center. But how I best operate is having my computer and the patient's information right in front of me while I'm with the patient in the room, and I can document everything real time. And I just wasn't able to do that at the Wound Care Center previously. It provided me a lot of frustration. I should have fixed that a long time ago, but it has been fixed now. So then I guess the issue after that is, should I have reviewed the vascular studies, would it have changed the care of the patient? And, you know, I can't say for certain because, you know, I'm not reviewing them in real-time fashion, but when I review them now, I interpret as normal ABIs and biphasic waveform, which, you know, as the report says, mild to moderate EAD, which I would not have immediately referred to a vascular surgeon. And in my few weeks' time with the patient, the wound was improving, and he had no other signs of peripheral arterial disease, so any suspicion that, you know, the arterial situation was delaying his wound healing just would have fallen from mind. You know, the wound was improving. I think the greatest challenge with the patient was that he was still working, and as was mentioned, he found the offloading shoe uncomfortable. And so my greatest focus was offloading with him each visit. And when the wound did not improve, that is when I did refer him to the vascular surgeon, wound care specialist, Dr. Labor. I think this would be a good time to discuss Dr. Polakoff bringing up, you know, lab work has been ordered, x-rays have been ordered. You know, the wound was improving, and I just generally don't order unnecessary tests. So we seem to be on the right track, and it wasn't until the surgical debridement that I noticed the wound was much deeper. Even though he has neuropathy that he states is pretty severe, he did have some sensitivity with the debridements. We have many neuropathic patients that have sensitivity with the debridements, and so the topical lidocaine is offered to all of them, and we did utilize it because of his sensitivity, and it was only under general anesthesia and able to do a more aggressive debridement that the wound was discovered to be more unstable. And, you know, in those cases, I generally suspect deeper infection, such as osteomyelitis. So I ordered the x-rays and MRI. That was negative, and that's when I referred him to Dr. Labor. And then the second toe on the left foot, surgical procedure, you know, believed to be unrelated to the right heel wound and the arterial status. Pretty straightforward treatment of the DIPJ hammer toe contracture, which is causing a pressure ulcer on the tip of the toe. I obtained informed consent from him. Did the procedure, and unfortunately, he didn't heal well. We understand complications are a risk of surgery, which was included in the consent. He has an unstable gait secondary to his neuropathy and the concomitant hallux valgus deformity, which are likely the greatest contributors to why the toe did not heal in a rectus position. And I think for the last issue regarding the coating, the modifier was used. That wound care is complex and it's multifaceted, and we can prescribe offloading devices, but as the patient mentioned, it wasn't comfortable. We discussed this every visit. I think, you know, we can see that, you know, Mr. R is intelligent. He asks questions. He can also be a little bit of a circumnavigating communicator. So we had lengthy discussions about, you know, everything related to the wound care each visit. He didn't ask me about his arterial studies, and, you know, as I've mentioned, that fell off of my radar, unfortunately. And so I do believe that the use of the 99213 with the 11042 was justified given the extent of the complexity and the level of care. And I'm happy to answer any questions related to any of that. Thank you.
Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions?
You answer my questions with the x-rays. Did you take any of the tissue that you, when you did the deep debridement in the OR, did you take any of that tissue for biopsy?
Not that I saw.
Okay. And in the notes, did you document that you had lengthy discussions with the patient, and that's what, because I think Dr. Polakoff had more of a problem with the 99213 billing with the debridement code.
and there needs to be a medical reasoning why you're doing an EM visit.
Correct. And unfortunately, no, I probably don't have the documentation to support it. Again, with the inefficient way the wound care center works, having lack of computer did contribute to those deficiencies, and I am working to improve my documentation.
Okay. Okay, that's all the questions I had. Thank you.
Dr. Ilano, sir.
Hi, Dr. Houston. Good morning. My question to you, when you build those 99213s, was it all related to the ulcers, or did you talk about other things?
Both. You know, we would talk about nutrition, and I guess, you know, offloading is related to the ulcers, but, you know, coordination of home supplies, how's the patient doing at home, what are the circumstances that, you know, are contributing to the failure of the wound to improve faster.
And you feel like, that wasn't in your TART notation?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Did you put that in your chart notation?
Probably not well enough.
Okay. Yeah, I would say in the future, if you're going to build a 99213, you've got to put that in your charting. When the ABI or the study that was performed on 617, was that ever placed in your charting system, your EMR?
It was.
When was it placed?
I think on the 24th. It was placed fairly short after he had them done.
Okay. And you just weren't aware that was in place in your EMR?
Correct.
Okay. And now you have safeguards to alert you?
Yes. We have the team approach, checks and balances, and having my direct computer access with me helps significantly.
Okay. Do you get a lot of referrals from nurse practitioner Keel?
I do.
Okay. Do you discuss if there's a problem with their arterial studies usually?
I don't know about specific tests. I'm going to guess in this situation, Kelly didn't follow up with the studies either, just because she had referred the patient to me and more or less signed off. But we touch base regularly. Before she sends me a patient, she'll usually call me and give me a summary and kind of what her expectations of me are.
Okay, but you don't recall having that conversation with DR?
Correct.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Dr. Huston, this is Dr. Campbell. I have some questions for you. I'm just very curious why, when you knew that those tests had been done and you documented in your chart that you're going to follow up, why you didn't follow up with the test that was ordered? Because, you know, you're still the captain of the ship here with your patient. So that's one point that I really have difficulty with, is that's a responsibility of you. Because, I mean, if you had ordered, you know, any other test, an x-ray, wouldn't you want to find out those results?
Yes, absolutely. I do regret significantly that it doesn't appear I did review those while they were in the chart. They weren't specifically placed in front of my face, which would be a good reminder to do it. I know I was documenting it in the note, but my documentation would often be completed long after I had seen the patient, and then I would have to remember the next time I see the patient to go over those results. And I'm not going to make an excuse. I mean, it was a significant oversight, and I do not want it to happen again.
Well, and I will appreciate the fact that you have obviously sounds like you've been trying to take action to make improvement. I'm curious too with on the ABIs. You know, here you've got a person who's hypertensive, and you know when a vessel has issues with compressibility, that your ABIs can certainly be. Sometimes they're not totally reliable. So that's just something I think in the whole picture here that maybe, I don't know if it was overlooked. And, you know, the patient has sleep apnea, and that can, you know, that's oftentimes is related to the development of diabetes. And as the complainant indicated, that he was considered a pre-diabetic before losing weight, but again, that was nothing that ever saw documented in the chart. And I would like to know, and I know to ask you this, is that what was the result of the peer review at TMC?
Excuse me, Dr. Campbell, this is Bruce Crawford. If you're going to talk about peer review, I think you're going to have to talk about that in executive session with the doctor privately, because that's not supposed to be shared publicly.
Okay. That's Seamus, is that?
I mean, I don't have any problem. I don't have any problem with the doctor.
Okay.
Giving you that information, but it is supposed to be protected.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think, you know, obviously, there's been a lot of issues brought up from all parties involved here, and I think we're at that point where, you know, this is just the initial review, and in this discussion, I think, you know, we definitely have questions of violations of standards of care. But it's not at the level of, you know, revoking, suspending licenses, things. I do believe this is at the point where I would move this to an informal hearing so that more discussion can occur and more, you know, evidence presented and other issues of things that we are finding that we don't have present in the file that needs to be reviewed. So that's why I would make a motion to move this file 20-04-C to an informal interview, citing the following possible violations of state statutes. 32-854.01 is heading for unprofessional conduct. Number 21 reads, committing any conduct or practice that is or might be harmful or dangerous to the health of the patient. Number 24 reads as charging or collecting a clearly excessive fee. In determining the reasonableness of a fee, the fee is customarily charged in the locality for a similar service shall be rendered, considered in light of modifying factors such as time required, complexity of service, skill requisite to perform the service properly. This paragraph does not apply if there is a clear written contract for a fixed fee between the podiatrist and the patient that has been entered into before the licensee provides the service. And the last is number 20, which reads, having the licensee's license refused, revoked, suspended, or any other licensing jurisdiction for inability to safely and skillfully practice podiatry or for unprofessional conduct as defined by that jurisdiction that directly, strike that. So the issues that we talked about for the the other that can be discussed in executive session at another at this venue at the informal. So that does not need to be cited as a statute then. I'm asking this of our AG. So, okay, so strike number 20. So we do, the two that are listed as possible violations are number 21 and number 24. Do I have any, or do I have a second for that motion?
I second the motion.
Thank you, Dr. Ilano. Do we have any further discussion on this motion? Okay, we'll take a voice vote on that. Dr. Ilano.
Aye.
Dr. Foreman.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell. Aye.
John Rhodes, aye.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Rhodes. I didn't know you were there. Okay. Thank you so much. So it's been moved and seconded and unanimously voted to move 20-04-C to an informal interview. Heather will, with Mr. Monahan, will provide the details to you, Dr. Huston, and to Mr. Crawford, your counsel, on when the informal interview will be scheduled. So thank everyone for their time. And we'll move on to our next agenda item. Thank you.
Okay, so we will hang up. Dr. Huston, hang up. I'll give you a call.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crawford. Okay, so looks like...
Madam Chairman. This is DR. From my information, someone will communicate to me as this proceeds, or how does this work?
Yes, Heather Broaddus, our executive director, will be in contact with you.
Okay.
All righty.
I just wanted the clarification. I'm not familiar with your procedure, so I just thought I'd ask.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And I will hang up as well. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So we will then move on to renewal applications, which is E, for a licensing and dispensing registrations. We have Marissa Lardzabal? Could you pronounce your name, doctor? I don't like butchering people's names.
Hi, good morning. It's Marie Lardzabal.
Okay, thank you. So we will, let me grab my other notes here. So here. Let me get to the right section here. Got a lot here, so just give me a moment while I find my note. All right, here we are. So you noted on your application the malpractice case that was actually dismissed with prejudice, and we received the supplemental letter from your attorney indicating that action. So is there a comment that you wanted to make in regard to that?
No, I just wanted to be available if there was anything else that I needed to, answer or explain, but I think everything is summarized in that supplementary material.
Okay, thank you. And Heather, everything's complete with her. She's completed her CMEs and everything, correct? Okay, so then I will go ahead and make a motion to accept their renewal application for her license to practice podiatry as well as her dispensing registration license to the doctor, seeing that she everything is complete with her application, and fees have been paid correctly. Correct. Yes. And who seconded?
Yes. Seconded.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. So moved. Thank you, doctor, for being available.
No problem. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, so then let's go back to number one under the same heading of Nicole Adams. And also, Dr. Adams did notice a malpractice case. She has paid her renewal fee for the licensing and for dispensing. She does have her CME credits. And at this time, we don't have any other information as to where the malpractice case is, only that it does involve multiple defendants. So seeing that she is complete in her application and fees are paid, I would move to accept the application and relicense Dr. Nicole Adams for her general license and dispensing license.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. I would we can just direct Heather to do as we've done in the past, just ask the doctor to keep us posted on where things are with this malpractice case. Everybody okay on that?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. All right. Let's move to number three is Donald Shuddy.
No. Did we miss Brewer?
We're going to do that. It's just I was going to.
Okay.
Yeah. On Dr. Chuddy, he asked for. Originally, it asked for the extension because of the issues with Western, and he's complete though, right? He's complete too on his hours now.
Yes, and that would be. The same for Denise Freeman, DPM, and for Tanya Toms, DPM. So all three of those licensees requested the continuance extension because of the Western Conference, but have since submitted all of their continuing education requirements.
So can we take those in mass, or do we have to do each one separate? I can't remember what we did. Okay. So... as per information that Heather just presented to us, I will make a motion to accept the renewal application for Dr. Donald Shuddy, seeing that the application is complete, the fees are paid.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Okay. Opposed? None, so moved. Next applicant is number four, Dr. Denise Freeman. Seeing that, I will make a motion to accept Dr. Freeman's application for a license and dispensing registration as her license is complete. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Number six is Dr. Tanya Toms. I will make a motion to accept Dr. Toms's renewal application for licensure and dispensing as the application is complete and fees are paid.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right, now we will move on to number two, Dr. Michael Brewer. So Dr. Ulano is recused from this discussion. I'm sorry, Dr. Ulano, can you make your statement? Thank you for reminding me, Seamus.
Oh, sure. You know, I Heather gave me an email in regard to Dr. Brewer. The statements that he made in there were false in regards to me. I did have a conversation with Dr. Brewer in a three-way phone conversation with another person, but this was all regards to his practice. Then when Dr. Brewer changed the subject and talked about the CME extension, I just shut it down. I informed Dr. Brewer I cannot talk about board matters without the presence of quorum or the board members. That's all I'd like to say.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So I'm going to have Heather go ahead and give the story of what's transpired here.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Recently, I received a request from Dr. Brewer regarding a six-month extension for his continuing education requirements. And I did respond to Dr. Brewer a very detailed email. And in that, I did advise Dr. Brewer that I still had not received his renewal application and that if he does not submit his renewal application by August 31st of 2020, then his license would be canceled. I also explained to Dr. Brewer that all of the continuing education requirements could be met online. I advised Dr. Brewer of several different websites that is offering online continuing medical education. And I let him know in the email that I detailed to him that the board would be reviewing his extension request for 6 months. But I also strongly advised him to complete as much continuing education as he could electronically. He was also sent a board notice in the mail to the most current mailing address that I have. And as far as I'm aware, Dr. Brewer is not present. I did follow up with him to ask if he would be at the meeting today, and I've not heard a response from him at this time. So currently, what is before the board is I do not have a renewal application at this time, but Dr. Brewer did request a six-month extension to complete his continuing education requirements. So that is what is before the board. And I can answer any questions if you have any questions.
Did Dr. Brewer make any reason he could not do those online credits?
I apologize, Dr. Foreman. Can you read that?
Sure. Did Dr. Brewer make any comment why he could not do the credits online?
Dr. Brewer's email to me was pretty short. He's indicating that he has taken calls from numerous different hospitals, so he's like on call with those hospitals. He has had providers come down with COVID, et cetera. He didn't go into a lot of detail, but he did, cite the COVID situation and that he's just been very busy. That was what I got out of his email.
Okay, thank you.
And this is Heather Broaddus again. Can I confirm whether or not Dr. Brewer is present telephonically? So it doesn't appear that he is present telephonically. Again, this is Heather Broaddus, and I apologize. Dr. Campbell just had to step out for 1 second. She just returned. So, again, what is before the board is Dr. Brewer's six-month extension request to complete his continuing education requirements.
You know, there's no extenuating circumstances here.
And this was done outside of the Attorney General's office. This was done by the executive orders and the administrative order. And as I remember, this is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. If memory serves me, we did not waive requirements because they could be done online, as was mentioned in the executive orders and the administrative order. So the board, however, does have the option to give the licensee a extra 60 days to complete their continuing education.
But the fact that he hasn't even presented his application for relicensure.
Yes, he would need to do that so that the board could grant that, yes.
Yeah, so this needs to be tabled till next month, right? Do we have to, if he's not made an application,
You could deny the six-month extension, as you
go ahead. And
as I understand it, you wouldn't have the authority to do that anyways. And then what you would table is if he sends in a license, if he renews but doesn't have his CE, then you have the option to give him the extra 60 days to finish.
Please repeat that.
If he turns in a renewal application and doesn't have the CE hours, the board can give him an extra 60 days at that point to finish those hours. But we would need a renewal application from him.
So we're kind of, like I said, we have to wait for the renewal, right, before we can give him the extension.
Yes.
I want to make sure I got that straight in my head.
So, Madam Chair, this is Heather Broaddus. If I can just ask for a clarification. So if Dr. Brewer were to submit his renewal application and I administratively review it, determine that all aspects of the renewal meet the requirements except for his continuing education, can the board give me the authority today to just give him that 60-day extension in the event that he did submit his renewal, or do we have to wait to actually get his renewal in for the board to review the request, I guess is what I'm asking.
I think that the board could make a motion to delegate that authority to you based on him putting in all his renewal requirements minus the CE. I don't see a problem.
I think that's perfectly acceptable. And then Heather just contacts me whenever, or contacts me and yourself when that happens. I'll just go ahead and make that a formal motion. as to what Heather just said. Is so that be, acceptable?
Yeah, a motion to delegate to Heather.
I will make a motion then to delegate the responsibility to our executive director, Heather Broaddus, to proceed with Dr. Michael Brewer, a request for the continuing education for 60 days upon receipt of proper application for licensure.
Perfect.
Do I have a second?
Seconded.
Pardon me?
That will include the $150 penalty, correct?
Yes, it will.
Yes, you are correct, Mr. Rhodes. Thank you for reminding of this. And do I need to have an addendum to include that?
No, that's board policy.
Okay, board policy. Okay, thanks anyway, guys. Okay, so we have a second. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you. Okay, so let's go back up here to, hang on a second. We've got, it's not moving, come on. Hang on, my computer's kind of acting up. Okay, here we go. So C, this is our applications here for practice. Our first is Ryan Bangart, and everything is in place here for Dr. Bangart, but he will not complete his residency till September 12th. The letter from the residency director says he's in good standing and expects completion, so there's nothing in there that says he has completed residency requirements. So, and he has paid for his application fee. I will move to approve Dr. Bangart's application for licensure and to issue the license after he presents the residency completion certificate and payment of the appropriate fee for that.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Our next is Dr. Thomas Curtis. Doctor completed his residency on 6/30 of 20. Everything in his application is complete, and his license application fee is paid. So I will move to approve Dr. Thomas Curtis' application and license for licensure as it is complete. All requirements have been met, and to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you. All right, then we have applications for dispensing drugs and devices. These are all initial ones. So our first is Jessica Arnonson. She has her fee been paid, Heather? I did not see that on the application.
Yes.
She did pay. Okay, great. So, and her chart appears to, everything is complete for her application, so I'll make a motion to approve and accept the initial application for Dr. Arnonson to dispense drugs and devices.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Our next applicant is Pyranka Bagur. DPM, everything is complete, fee's been paid. So I make a motion to approve and accept the initial application to dispense drugs and devices for Dr. Bagur.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Next is Dr. Devin Bland. Dr. Bland, his application is complete and fee paid. So I will make a motion to approve and accept Dr. Bland's initial application to dispense drugs and devices.
Second.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Next doctor is Jordan Grafton. Application complete and fees paid. So make a motion to accept and approve Dr. Grafton's initial application to dispense drugs and devices.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Our next is Ian Newport. Fees paid. Application is complete. So I make a motion to accept and approve Dr. Newport's initial application to dispense drugs and devices.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Next is Dr. Sophia Stocks. Again, application is complete and fee is paid, so I make a motion to accept and approve Dr. Stocks' initial application to dispense drugs and devices.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Our next is F, is the request for continuing education from Dr. James Dancho at Tucson Residency Program. Everybody's had the opportunity to review Dr. Dancho's CME list. Anybody have any concerns? Okay. Then hearing no concerns, I would move to accept Dr. Dancho's request for CME approval for the 43 hours at the VA program in Tucson.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Next is G, is the discussion about extending deadlines for continuing medical education.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. Due to the current health crisis, all of the in-person conferences were canceled. And as you are aware, a lot of those conferences were going to be happening in April, May, and June. And recently, several licensees have contacted me regarding the Western Conference that was at the end of June, and many licensees have signed up for this conference, and the details of the conference were not made available regarding how many hours they were going to receive prior to June 30th. So a lot of licensees were only able to obtain half of the required hours prior to June 30th, and then the Western Conference was opening up modules in July for licensees to obtain the rest of the required 25 hours. And as you're aware, all continuing medical education must be completed by June 30th of each year. So after consultation with the board chair and the board's assistant attorney general, it's been determined that the board may extend a 60-day continuance to all licensees under ARS 32-829E. Any licensee requesting an extension past that August 31st deadline, the board would hear those cases independently. So it's before the board to determine whether or not it would be acceptable to give that 60-day extension until August 31st. And I can answer any questions you may have.
Heather, it's no fault of the licensees. It's the CMEs from the California that delayed this. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, as I stated, the details regarding how many continuing education requirements prior to June 30th was not made available. Several of the licensees that contacted me did not know that they wouldn't be able to obtain all of the CME prior to June 30th.
So then we just need a motion to extend that. And then that will, yeah, right.
Yeah, the right. Motion to extend that.
And
that
this is done on a case-by-case basis, right, yeah. Heather?
The request that I had put in the materials was to just extend all licensees until August 31st, 2020. So if I were to get a late renewal today and I noted that some of the CME was completed after June 30th, I would still be able to renew that licensee without having to bring it to the board. Now, any licensee who wants the extension past August 31st, the board would hear on a case-by-case basis, because under ARS 32-829, the board can extend the CME requirement by 60 days. And if I may, too, I just wanted to extend it to all licensees, partly because of the current health crisis.
Okay, so how should that motion read? What's the best way to be inclusive?
This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. Maybe something to the effect of due to the current COVID situation and the National Conference for Podiatrists, the board is using its authority under 829E to extend CME requirements by 60 days to August 31st.
So, and I would, if no one else has any other questions or points they'd like to discuss, I will make a motion to give the board has the authority due to the current situation of the COVID-19 and issues related to seminars for physicians that the board I will extend the right to extend the deadline for continuing education as per ARS 32-829E for a 60-day extension, which would be taken on a case-by-case basis.
After Seconded. August 31st.
After August 31st of 2020. That makes sense. That's kind of long-winded. Sorry. Any second on that?
Second.
Any discussion?
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you. All right. We need to go back to the minutes number 4. First is our July 8th, 2020 general session board meeting minutes. Does anyone have any concerns or additions, corrections to be made to the minutes? Then seeing no comments, I will move to accept the minutes as written for the general session date 7-8-2020.
Second.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Foreman, you were not present at that meeting, so You'll need to abstain voting for both the general session and the executive session. So, did I have a second?
Yes, Rhodes.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Okay, any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And in regards to the executive session minutes from 7/8/2020, does anybody have any corrections or additions to make? Okay, seeing none, I will make a motion to accept the executive session meeting minutes as written for 7/8/2020.
Second.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. Then let's go here back to Heather's executive director's report six.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Regarding the rulemaking process, I received notification from the Secretary of State's office that the board's rule package will become effective on September 6th of 2020. The renewal cycle is almost completed. I'm guessing that the majority of the licensees are going to renew, which is good given the current situation. And then in regards to the sunset audit, I did make the board aware that it is going through a self-sunset audit. I did respond to the 17 questions that the board is required to answer. I attached that report for the board's review, and the report is due by September 1st, and with the board's approval, I will submit it to the governor's office.
Does anyone have any questions for Heather on her report? Because she did a very nice job, as always. So,
looks great.
I will then make a motion to accept the sunset self audit report that Ms. Broaddus did, that she will submit to the governor's office. Do I have a second? Thank you so much. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. And the only other updates that I have is I did attach a current budget. I can answer any questions on that. And the complaint log for those members in person, I did attach a current complaint log. I received a new complaint today that is not on the complaint log, though.
And so next month, we will be having
5 complaints and 1 informal.
Hello?
Dr. Foreman?
Yeah, I got disconnected. Sorry.
That's okay.
All righty. Okay, so our next is any summary of current events?
I do not have any.
Okay, and then 8 is call to the public. And I guess we can include like good and welfare in there, correct? Do a call to the public. Like good and welfare, can that be included in there? Or can I just make a general, can I make a general comment? That time frame, or should I have done it in the summary of current events?
Probably.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go back to the summary of current events. I wanted to apologize that I had inadvertently, you know, last month I indicated why Dr. Foreman was not present, that his father had passed, and previous to that, Mr. Rhodes had told me that his nephew had passed, Sean Davis. So. Just wanted again to express condolences, and then our Dr. Cohn, who's one of our investigators, his father had also passed over a month ago. So I apologize for inadvertently omitting those. So, and we have our call to the public, and we don't have any public to call. Does anybody have anything that they'd like to see on future meetings, any agenda items for future meetings? Okay. And our next board meeting is scheduled for September the 9th. And at 11:26, saying that all business is completed, unless somebody else has something else, I will move to adjourn the meeting. Do I have a second? Okay, any discussion?
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.